Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about food. What should you prepare for your game? How should you prepare it? Who should you enjoy it with? On this episode of Wandering DMs.
So Dan is up visiting me for the weekend, and we thought, what could we do that maybe makes use of the fact that we're both here in the same space? And
specifically in Paul's kitchen.
Yeah, so right. Why not? Let's talk about food.
Let's do this. Yeah. So on this episode of Wandering DMs, Paul, we are going to be making our famous Wandering DMs white gold cookies.
Mmm, delicious.
Over the course of the show. Yes, I hope so. So for this recipe today, I got some brown sugar, got some white sugar, some flour here. I got an egg, have some butter here that's been softening for the past hour or so here in the bowl. Sometimes I microwave that before I use this. I got vanilla, baking powder, salt, white chocolate chips, that's an important part, and also some cranberries here that we'll be putting in. We'll be describing how we're going to use this as we go forward. Got some baking sheets that have been buttered up. And the oven has been preheated to 350 degrees.
Excellent.
Yes.
Let's get started.
Great. So the first thing I'm going to do is I got the butter here, and I'm going to put in, I'm going to make in kind of like a half serving, kind of a small serving. This will make around 20 cookies. If you want to make more, of course, like double the ingredients as I do this. First thing I'm going to do, I have one stick of butter. I'm going to put in half a cup of white sugar and half a cup of brown sugar and kind of mix that stuff up as the first step.
Great. So we already have a comment here in our chat on your lovely apron. Would you like to tell our guests about where this apron comes from?
Thank you for asking, actually. Yeah. So we wanted a D&D themed apron, and so this apron represents the fact that I probably just had to defeat 15 bugbears and a dragon before getting all the supplies, such as the white gold and the cranberries and so forth. This apron was actually designed, Paul, by Brooklyn fine artist Isabel Garbani.
Excellent.
Who we have had on the show in the past, but will probably not ever appear on the show again after she dissed Dave Trampier's art on the Art in D&D show. So this is thank you, Ms. Garbani, for this, and we enjoyed having you the one time that we did. Going in here. Half a cup of white sugar is what's going here.
So let's talk a little bit as you do this about how you incorporate food into games. And there's a couple different ways we can talk about this, but perhaps we can just start with do you have food at the table while you're gaming? How much of a part of gaming is food for you?
Well, that's really interesting. So, I mean, a lot of people like have at least snacks at the table.
Yeah.
And as we were talking to some friends the other day, like I might be in the minority of usually not having that at the table. So I have a friend who usually hosts our game. His name is Max. I don't know if you know who that is, Paul.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. So he hosts the games, and he usually gets pizza for all of us beforehand.
Nice.
And then sometimes we might have we might possibly have cookies or alcohol at the table. That's usually about as much as we usually
pizza
have.
Pizza is certainly very very traditional gaming fare.
Right.
And I know when we did our July game over the course of a whole weekend,
right.
We had to take breaks, to go and eat food or whatnot.
Right.
Generally did that off stream, right? So that was our excuse to stop streaming for a little while and go feed ourselves. And my own Sunday evening game, usually after the show, I'm off to go play 5th edition D&D with my regular group. And that always includes dinner, actually. So we meet at from 5 to 9, we play.
Okay.
And usually around 6 o'clock, so when we show up, we make an order from a local delivery place.
Right.
And around 6 o'clock, it shows up, and so we break the game.
Okay.
So
we've
played for
oh.
maybe an hour, half an hour to an hour.
Oh, really?
Then we take a break, and we eat our food, and we chat, sometimes about the game, sometimes about politics or sports or whatever.
Right.
So we have a little, just a quick little downtime, a little break there in the middle.
I hadn't heard that before. I think a lot of people, they have a regular get together and maybe they'll have a regular meal right before it. I know that when I was actually my first gaming job, actually, which is Papyrus Racing in Boston, we had a regular Warcraft game, and we would go across at night. We'd go across the street to the Old Country Buffet. And then come back and we play Warcraft, and so we would march across the street and we would all yell out, "First we feast, then we war!" every time we do that. So I think a number of groups do that, but having the break in the middle is really interesting. So let me just put in the next thing here. So now I'm putting in one egg, and I'm going to put in 1 teaspoon of vanilla and mix all that up in there.
Excellent. Nailed it. You know, so we have an annual convention that we go to that's just a group of friends called HelgenCon that happens in April.
Fantastic.
And, you know, there was sort of that involves a lot of food as well, right? So, in fact, that's like the one part of the organization of that convention. I actually have another friend who took that over and organized the food.
Right, right.
But basically, I collect money from everyone who comes to pay for the rental of the house, but also sufficient money to buy all the food for the whole weekend. Right. And we do a sign-up over the weekend of different volunteers signing up to make this meal or that meal.
Right.
And the funny thing is, the way that usually ends is on Sunday, we have one last game Sunday morning from like 10 to 2, and then everyone bails. And so we have this big sort of rolling Sunday brunch where all the food that didn't get eaten over the course of the weekend is put out in the kitchen, and whatever's left, please eat, right? And so oftentimes, you'll be sitting there playing at a table, and somebody will notice, "Oh my gosh, there's all this food over here. Let me bring some to the gaming table."
Yeah, good point.
And if you remember, we had a game that featured battle cheese.
Yes.
And you remember that?
Yes, I do. Remind me.
So I believe you were DMing, and you know, we're playing a fairly intense old school D&D game, and somebody just had, you know, just blocks of cheese left over from some previous meal, brought it over, and presented battle cheese so that we could, you know, sustain ourselves throughout the combat. And that became a rallying cry, I think, for that group. Battle cheese!
Was I actually DMing for that?
I thought you were DMing.
I don't remember that. What do you mean when I'm DMing? I don't have any real cognizance. My awareness of outside the game is not there so well. Funny. Interesting. That's great. That's great. Some people do it more elaborately. Like, I've heard people, like, they have a regular, like, you know, cooking session, a whole, you know, multi-course meal before the game.
Yeah, you know, friend, amazing. One of the friends of the show, Brenda Flynn, was telling us about how it was actually a whole ritual of preparing the food together. Right. The whole group would come together, make a meal together, and then sit down to game.
Right, right, which is great.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense, right? It's a very social activity, gaming, and so incorporating a meal into that.
Yeah, it's really natural. Among the two most social things you can do. Is you're getting together with friends, it's a recuperation recovery time for everybody, and it really actually makes a whole lot of sense that social together time is actually very similar.
So, disinvited artist Isabel Garvani would like to know if you're going to actually shape the cookies into something like a dragon or a troll or something D&D themed for
There us. Was some consideration to possibly putting them in the shape of D20s, actually, but in order to pull that off, I felt like icing would be necessary. So that might possibly be a really good suggestion for a future episode of Wandering DM's cooking shows in Paul's Kitchen. But that wasn't the plan for today. Okay. It's going to be lumpy.
That's great.
It's going to be a little lumpy. So what I'm putting in right now is I'm putting in half a teaspoon of baking powder right here. And I'm also putting in, I guess, a quarter teaspoon of salt. Just a little bit of salt there.
Great.
Mixing all that in.
I'm reminded that when we go to TotalCon, they have, you know, it's mostly RPGs at TotalCon. It happens in February in Marlboro. And we've cast last year from there live at the convention, and we probably will again. They have a small exhibit hall with maybe half a dozen or maybe 8 or 10 different booths of where you can buy various game related stuff. And one booth that shows up every year is this lovely company that makes cupcakes.
Oh, really?
Right, and very much D&D.
Oh, right.
I wish I knew their name.
Right, right.
I'd give them the plug, but. Right. It's really become a very strong tradition of that convention is that these cupcakes showing up. And I think they do clever things where they like they'll sell you a roll of a D20 for a random chance of a free cupcake.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So really it's great stuff. They're really beautiful, really nice. Gorgeous cupcakes and quite delicious. And that's a lot of fun. Okay, so aside from just the mechanics of eating at the table, what about actually incorporating food into your game itself?
Well, obviously, that's something that has, you know, at the outset, right? D&D initially was, you know, war game based, and, you know, resource management based. So obviously at the outset, in the very short list of equipment in original D&D, you had rations. You had two types of rations, your standard rations, your iron rations, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And actually at this point, I'm going to be putting... I have this mixture of sugar and butter and vanilla and baking powder and things like that kind of mixed up pretty well. Now I'm putting in quite a bit of flour here, so this is going to be a cup and a half of flour. And I will mix all that up. So at the outset, the resource management of, coming out of the outdoor survival game of what does it take to, I guess I'll stir this up and put some more in, of what does it take to survive in the wilderness as far as rations and water and being lost was a really core part of the game. When I run games now, that tends to surprise new players the first time. Mm-hmm. So with my current play group, the first time they went in the wilderness, only one kind of slightly more expert player knew to get rations. And they were out for about a week. And then I was like, please consume your rations? And 4 out of 5 players were like, I was supposed to do what now? And they actually rapidly started starving to death. And then they got lost, right? And then they're in pretty bad shape. And after that, so they actually were on the cusp of starving to death in their first wilderness adventure. Mm-hmm. And after that, they got the message. And after that, they've been really, really on the ball about making sure that they have rations before That's they funny. Go in the wilderness.
Now, have you ever, as a DM, killed a player through starvation?
I don't think so, but yeah. I'm willing to. I'm happy to, right? And there was the game that you were playing in where the party got teleported, basically into an arid plain area where you didn't have water. And the question there was, you'd left all your water behind with the horses, and the whole party was about to... about to TPK the whole party based on not having any water.
Fortunately, we had a very, very clever player, a friend of ours, Dave, who was playing a reasonably high-level magic user, and realized that he could create a wall of ice. So conjured a wall of ice so that we could then gather the melting water off of the wall of ice. Yeah. Which is great.
Which again had made me think: and some people nowadays would say, like, if the spell doesn't say it, right? The spell doesn't explicitly say you can get drinkable water off this, and the spell doesn't permit this. But in old school D&D, it seems reasonable. If you have a big block of ice in a hot terrain, it seems like it would melt, and you could gather it. So I said yes to that. So don't say I never gave my players any rulings in their favor, because I did in that case. But it was very clever. You'd be hard-pressed to say no to that. Got one more half cup of flour going in there. Great. So do you feel like in new school... I mean, you can talk about computer games too, right? Yeah. So if you go back to classic computer games that were inspired by D&D, like Rogue or NetHack or even Gauntlet or something like that, like the fact that... You're currently actually losing, you're on the cusp of losing your endurance and your health unless you're regularly eating was a major part of all those games. Or even like Dark Tower, right? So Dark Tower, the main thing you were balancing is you were trying to build a force of mercenaries to attack the tower, but the more mercenaries you have, the more rations you're consuming. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so sometimes it was advantageous to have a small number to move rapidly, and sometimes... you needed a lot for a fight, but then you're counterbalancing this with how many rations you can carry.
I mean, it's certainly the game itself has a lot of mechanics built in for managing this, right?
Yeah.
You have a lot of spells like create food and water.
Right, purify food and water.
You know, you have abilities, like oftentimes a ranger will have an ability that allows them to forage.
Right. Right?
That's certainly a labyrinth forge staple.
Yep.
I agree. It was a big part of the game for sure.
I agree. I saw recently there was an argument on Stack Exchange RPG about purify food and water, right? It's first level cleric spell. It's always been in the game. Does that let you purify salt water to be drinkable?
Interesting.
Right. It says purifying the title.
Right.
And I mean the description says if something's poison or toxic, it cleans that up so that it's safe. It's safe to eat or drink.
Seems to me pretty reasonable that it might desalinate salt water.
A whole lot of people said no. It's not poison. Is it poison? No. Salt is not poison. You need that in your body, as a matter of fact. Right? So no.
Yeah.
Purify food and water will not turn salt water to fresh.
Weird.
I mean, I don't actually have an opinion. Anyway, those were the two sides.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, Ash mentions to us in the chat that he plays with a group that has a lot of different dietary restrictions. And so often encourages everyone to bring a little something, right? So everybody brings something. It comes kind of a potluck, sounds like, kind of experience. So I totally sympathize with that. Personally, I'm a vegetarian. So that is something I also often have to look out for. And that's actually an excellent bridge to what I really want to get into is like actually using food as a prop in a game.
Oh, interesting. So, hold that thought.
Yeah, sure.
So now I'm putting, now I've got the batter sort of made up. You could make cookies out of this. I'm going to put in the white chocolate chips that represent the gold that you achieve at the end of your adventure, the white gold being poured into the batter here. And I'll mix that up. So yeah, how have you, I guess I haven't used food directly in the game as like a feature a lot.
So the first time I encountered this was at a Gen Con many years ago. I was playing a Cthulhu game. And the Cthulhu game centered around, we were an Arctic expedition. I think it's based on a famous Arctic expedition that got, where a bunch of ships got caught in the ice. Right, so they were stuck there in the ice for an extended period of time. And so we were dealing with deprivation, you know, one of the historic problems that this particular expedition had is they had a lot of tinned food, but tinning was new at that time. And so it was actually inedible because of the poor tinning process.
Now, a little footnote. See, you know, historically, that's what iron rations actually are, right? So iron rations were actually something that came up in World War I and actually referred to the iron cans.
Oh, interesting.
That soldiers circa World War I carried around as like emergency foodstuffs if they got cut off from their normal food supplies. And I think a lot of us, you know, maybe Gary Gygax might have slightly misinterpreted that as like, you know, hard bacon, you know, hard small preserved meats, which is not exactly what that was.
We'll get back to my story in a second. Okay. I'm kind of curious, actually, because this is a question I have to answer at the table a lot of times.
Yeah.
Often, my players will ask me, what is the difference between standard and iron rations?
Yeah. So
what do you tell them?
In Gary's mind, it was the difference between, like large items like bread and flour versus preserved items like, you know, bacon or hardtack.
Right. Well, how do you adjudicate that mechanically, though?
Right. But I think a lot of people, but for me, I actually do sit in my table, like actually if you look at my equipment list, I actually strike it out of the equipment list, as a matter of fact. But secretly, don't tell any players and don't let them hear this, secretly there are some dwarven enclaves that actually do have tin can technology and can batch up stuff in iron cans. Only the dwarves know how to do this. And then it is lighter and it lasts for a whole year instead of like just a couple weeks.
Interesting.
So usually like with my players, I say at the start of a session, strike out all the rations that you had from last time. They're all gone. You have to rebuy it every time we sit at the table.
So generally,
but if you had iron rations, they would last.
Normal rations you allow to last some number of weeks?
Yeah, like 2 weeks.
Okay, interesting. Interesting. So the way I've always ruled it, it's a little different.
So now I'm going to put in the cranberries. And Paul, the cranberries represent the 100 or 200... hearts or giblets of kobolds or goblins that you had to carve through in order to get all this wonderful foodstuffs here. So in go the hearts and the entrails of the various beings you had to destroy.
So the way I've ruled it is more in line with the Gygax interpretation that there are different kinds of food.
Right.
And this is purely stuff I've made up because no book has told me to do this. Right.
Right.
I'm looking at you know, mostly BX type stuff where you're buying rations by the week, right?
Right.
It's usually a week of standard, a week of iron.
Yep.
Iron costs more. No explanation of what that means.
True.
What I've ended up ruling is that standard rations are sort of normal foodstuffs, perishable foodstuffs, which I say won't last more than 1 week.
Okay.
1 week out in the open. I mean, there's no refrigeration, right? This stuff's going to go bad.
Yep.
So it's, in fact, useless to buy more than 1 week of standard rations.
Oh, interesting.
Because they will go bad.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And then iron rations I allow to last up to 4 weeks.
Okay. I think that is what it is in that version of the book. I think Frank Mentzer's book says that, is that standard rations last 1 week and iron rations last up to 4 weeks.
Either I've somehow managed to completely internalize Mentzer's ruling just happily came up with the exact same numbers.
I think that's probably what the situation
was. That's interesting.
Yeah. I think he had 1 week and 1 month, and I think I permit 1 month and 1 year.
So that's a very healthy-sized cookie you're making there.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, they're a little different from when I make cookies.
Okay.
So how big are these cookies going to be when you're done?
Great question, Paul.
Yeah.
Pretty big.
Yeah.
Pretty big. Maybe. We'll see. I mean, usually I like a big cookie. I like my cookies. Okay. I don't want to be. I don't want somebody to bogart my cookies. So yeah, they'll be healthy sized.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't know if they're gonna be the whole pan, but yeah, they're gonna be pretty healthy sized. At least that one is. Yep. So anyway, so if Paul's noticing that I am dolloping out. For me, large cookie sized. I'm a high level guy, so I'm going to take a big cookie onto the pre-greased pan.
Excellent.
Whatever size you prefer. Yeah.
All right. Let me get back to my Cthulhu story.
Right. Sorry.
Okay. So, So there was a playing Cthulhu game, and we're in the as mentioned in the Arctic, trapped on these boats. Right. And the DM actually, so it is a co-DM'd game. There were two DMs.
Oh, great.
Which is very interesting.
I love it.
One of them was more or less acting as the traditional DM, and the other was more sort of the gopher, the let me fill in stuff.
Okay.
And they did a lot of stuff to really push the setting. So we were in a small private ballroom. It's August. It's in Milwaukee, and actually maybe Indianapolis at that time. And they had closed the doors and like covered up any windows into the room or whatnot. This is just happenstance, by the way. I think they were just trying to block sound.
Okay.
But they had the small ballroom privately to themselves. And when you went in, it was noticeably cooler in the room, which was nice for a game set in the Arctic, right? Now, August, so like how much cooler is it really? We're still in shorts and t-shirts, but it was noticeably cooler. And they give us, each person at their spot, in addition to their character sheet, has these giant mittens. So we're wearing these giant mittens to pretend we're in the Arctic, and which is, of course, hilarious when you have to roll dice and wearing these huge, huge mittens. So obviously they were into that, and so the co-DM had a computer and was adding sound effects, and so there's a lot of elements of trying to push the scene, the mood, the environment for you. So one of the things that came up is at some point my character gets taken aside, ends up in a room, and... discovers a small piece of meat of questionable origin, right? So, obviously, like, cannibalism overtones here. And the DM actually presents me with a small piece of jerky.
Oh, geez.
And it was kind of heartbreaking for me because as a vegetarian, of course, I'm going to say no thanks.
Right.
As a role player, I was like, oh, it would be so much more interesting for my character to eat this.
Yeah, okay, yep, yep, yep.
And unfortunately, I don't think I had the... wherewithal at the moment to like articulate all that to him because I was in the game and I'm playing and I'm going, whoa, what is happening? This guy's offering me this weird sketchy piece of meat.
Yeah. For real.
Yeah, for real. For really like wacky. Ooh. Here you go. Right, role playing this NPC of, ooh, look, I found this thing.
Right.
I'm gonna put the
cookies in the oven right now. So this has been preheated to 350 and the idea is that it ought to be in about 30 minutes. We'll see. We're gonna check on it. So they offered you. So did anybody take that in the game?
Well, unfortunately, it was specifically offered to my character, who was alone in this scene. And I think the right thing to do now that I've had time to dwell on it is, I wish I had said, like, just sort of taken a moment to step out of the character and say, "Listen, in real life, I'm a vegetarian. But can you just say that my character ate that, please?"
Okay. Oh, you're right.
How about you eat it?
Understood.
You DM eat it for me. I know you're trying to give me immersive, and I appreciate your efforts in making this immersive for me. But as a vegetarian, I'm not gonna eat meat.
Yeah, of course.
For a role playing game.
Right.
So I wish I had done that.
Do you know? What do you think? Do you have any idea what the effect would have been if your character had eaten it?
No idea. Hmm. I don't know. Became a cannibal. Lost some sanity. I don't know.
Crazy.
Yeah, unfortunately, never got to find out.
So have you done props like that?
I have, actually. So I have here a game that I've run, another horror game called Something Stinks in Stilton. I believe that's available on DriveThruRPG. It is by the Melsonian Arts Council. and I believe it's originally written for Lamentations of the Flame Princess.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great adventure. So it's fantasy set, like Lamentation of the Flame Princess is, set in a quasi-historic European setting, right? Sort of Renaissance or medieval period.
Right.
And so it actually takes place in Stilton, where they make the cheese.
Right.
And the cheese features prominently in the game.
Yes.
It's a definite plot. I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but the cheese is an important part of the scenario. So when I run this game, I try to bring some Stilton to the table.
Okay.
As an
okay.
actual thing to present on the table. So when they arrive at the Bell Tavern and they order some food that has some cheese on it,
right.
I put out this nice cheese tray. And then I watch the players like a hawk. Because if any of them actually eats the cheese, I have to immediately ask for a saving throw.
Oh, nice.
And it takes them often a little bit to detect that's what's going on.
Gotcha.
Right, because they're all like, oh, cheese, right? The whole table's like, at least half the table is excited to have some cheese, right? delicious, tasty cheese. And so they start eating the cheese, and then I'm like, make a saving throw. And then they start realizing what's going on. And usually that's at least one person goes, I'm not going to eat the cheese.
Right.
I ended up making my own little handouts, which I think are on my blog somewhere. So if you just search my blog for Something Stinks in Stilton, I made actual menus for the tavern. So if you show up at the tavern, you can hand out these menus, which is a nice little handout.
Great.
Please do. There's both a food menu and a libations menu. Libations is really just for effect, just to make it feel good. The menu does have a little secret in it, if you can figure it out. You want to read to our audience what's on the menu?
Here is the menu in Paul's Something Stinks in Stilton game. I got four items here. Cheese board, classic plate of Sprintoff cheese. Did I read that right?
Oh, it should say Stilton. I have occasionally run this in Warhammer.
Right.
So in Warhammer, I translate Stilton to become Sprintoff.
Gotcha. Crusty bread and seasonal nuts and fruits for one silver piece. Second item, garlic roasted filet with a brandy Sprintoff again, sauce, roasted potatoes, and root vegetables for five silver pieces. That sounds delicious. Third item, roasted prime rib of beef. Au jus with a Sprintoff cream, mashed potatoes, and butternut squash. Eight silver pieces. And the last item, steak and ale pie. Slow-cooked steak, amber ale, and mushrooms served with mashed potatoes and seasonal greens. Three silver pieces. That sounds delicious. I don't see what the secret there is.
The fact is that every single item on the menu includes the cheese. The only one that doesn't specifically mention it is the last one, the steak and ale pie. But of course, being a pie, it's filled with a cheese sauce in addition to all the other items.
Brilliant.
So yeah, basically it's totally impossible to order anything that does not have the cheese in it or on it or some way.
Gotcha. The Sprintoff sauce, the Sprintoff cream.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, oh, good.
It's kind of like the Monty Python spam schedule.
Yeah, a little bit.
That's awesome. You know, Brooklyn-based fine artist Isabel Garbani, who I don't know, maybe she'll be on the show someday, but not in the near future, has recently been watching a show called The Terror on, I think on the Hulu service, actually, which is kind of like that Cthulhu game, 1800s ship, at least season one, 1800s ship, trapped in the ice of the Arctic. Yeah. What are we going to do? Running out of food.
It was a real event, so it was probably both based on the same historic event.
Yep.
Let me stop you for a second, Dan. Yep. Did you happen to set a timer for the cookies that you put in the
mentally.
Oven? Yeah, all right. Well, we're going to see how good
it is. At 152, they're supposed to be done, supposedly. Yeah, hopefully the Yeah, we'll see. Usually I have to check it. Hopefully it'll be done at a little bit before the end of the show. Actually, we'll be able to eat them. Yeah.
Sorry, I threw you. You were talking about the show, The Terror.
Yeah. That's the kind of like raw, concrete, real world detail that, I mean, we're all familiar with food. Obviously, mm-hmm. we're all familiar with what it's like to be hungry. So a scenario like that, I feel, where the food is running out seems to be very tangible and, as usual, usually turns my games into horror movies, intentionally or unintentionally.
Great.
Yeah. That seems like a detail that isn't usually in... Go ahead.
I was going to say, have you ever used or seen used food as a prop in an actual game?
You know, I actually haven't. I don't think I have. Unless my memory's bad, I don't think I personally have. That's not something I would honestly think of. You know, I've used other types of props, but I haven't used food.
I'm reminded actually now that there's another Cthulhu game I've run set in the 80s that has a drug is a major part of the plot line.
Right.
And so to represent the drug in the game, I actually take a couple of Smarties, which are just... You know, almost look like pills, right? Almost look like pills, Smarties. Okay. And you take a couple of those and you put them in a clear plastic baggie and it sure as heck looks like drugs.
Brilliant.
Right, so really? I hand those out to the players as a representation of the drugs. But again, I did exactly to one of my players right. what was done to me, where I had a player who couldn't have sugar, and okay. so wanted to like okay. partake in right. the drug, but was like, I can't right. eat sugar. And I was like, that's okay. fine. We'll just pretend.
Great. Yeah, that's the right choice.
Give me back the drugs and pretend yeah. your character ate them, yeah. and we'll forget about
it. Good call.
It.
Good call. Good call.
So there's another case that I could think of where I used.
Now another thing that happens is like, you know, sometimes people bring like a meal to the table. Like I've seen on Critical Role, I guess I've seen them actually eating during the show.
Yeah.
And I think on your 10 Dead Rats streaming show last Thursday, there were some players in the table. Is that acceptable? I mean, I might say, get that out of there. Get that. I don't know. That's a complete breach of etiquette.
I mean,
it's not something we're doing.
It's something we try to avoid, and we did discuss on the stream. Like, let's. We tried to time the stream in such a time that wouldn't interfere with people's meal time. But you know, things happen. Mm-hmm. Life happens. Things get in the way. Yeah. And someone comes running in and says, gosh, I haven't had a chance to eat.
Okay.
I don't want to starve you for hours while we play the game.
Okay.
Right? That seems pretty
interesting.
Cruel.
So no, I'm hearing no in-game punishment.
No. I try to.
I don't know. It seems like a lost opportunity.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I feel a little bit more okay with it because, like you said, I've seen it on other streams like Critical Role.
Right.
I've seen some of the players occasionally eat. Again, I think they are also trying to not do it regularly, right? It's
It's
a little distracting, let's be honest, for a show.
Yeah.
But
that show's 4 hours, and your show's only 2 hours. Your show is like a breeze. And if anybody had a limited amount of time, I think that your show would be an excellent option to, like, fill up their entertainment quotient or watch over dinner. I mean, it's a perfect thing to watch while they're eating dinner, I would recommend that. It's a lot to, much snappier show than that Critical Role thing.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. So one thing I saw in Stack Exchange, talking 5th edition games, right? So what in older school games would be the decanter of endless water, right?
Mm-hmm.
So nowadays the item is the alchemist jug, I was told, right?
Yep, that's what it's called.
And so it's a magic item that can produce a number of different substances, like some vinegar or something else.
Yeah, water, oil, wine, a lot of fairly normal things. And then the one very humorous item of 2 gallons of mayonnaise.
2 gallons of mayonnaise, right? Mm. So I think somewhere else in the rules you need 2 gallons of food per day or 2 pounds? Maybe it's 2 pounds of mayonnaise?
I'm pretty sure. I think it's a liquid measure. But
okay. So however it is, I think that the measurement of the mayonnaise exactly matches the daily food intake requirement in 5th edition D&D. So the question came up, does mayonnaise count as food? Like if you have an alchemist jug, right? So does mayonnaise count as a food product?
Hmm.
And if so, apparently there's a lot of players out there that want to get an alchemist jug in 5th edition and say, my character just eats mayonnaise every single day, day after day. Apparently 2 gallons of mayonnaise. Does that satisfy your food ration in 5th edition?
That sounds like a rough a rough lifestyle.
Okay. So you DM 5th edition game. So yes or no? I come in the game. I've got my alchemist jug. I just want to eat mayonnaise.
I would probably allow it to extend the duration by which you don't starve for a short period of time.
Okay.
But eventually, malnutrition I think is going to kick in because.
Okay.
Mayonnaise is not providing all the important nutrients that a body needs.
Counter argument: that's not written in the rules. It doesn't say any particular nutrient content.
You know, if I
in
had
fifth
a,
edition,
if
it
I
says just food, and I'm consuming it. I can digest it. It counts as food. So according to the letter of the rules, I should be able to exist indefinitely on my mayonnaise.
If I had a nickel for everything that wasn't in the rules that I had to make up on the fly, I wouldn't be doing this show. I'd be living it up to somewhere,
are you sure?
Somewhere tropical.
Are you sure you still wouldn't be doing the show?
No, you're right. It would have way better production values than I'd tell you that.
Well put. So the other thing, did I say this on the show? Did I do the purified food and water? Did I get that on the show? Was that pre-show?
Yeah, we talked about that. Salt and
all right. Okay, sorry. Okay, so that was the early early edition version.
I've heard an anecdote. I've heard an anecdote that's pretty amusing about that. The alchemist jug, which is that the designers when they were creating that magic item. They sat down and did a little brainstorming session where they listed out as many different things that they could think of that it might produce,
okay.
and then tried to whittle that list down to what you see presented in the player's handbook.
That's going to be DM's guide, probably.
That's going to be DM's guide, right? Okay. Anyway, so they had a huge list, and as I think, I'm sure that you and I both experienced, you get some designers in a room together brainstorming right. for a couple hours, and some really ridiculous things come out.
Right.
And so when they whittled down the list, they got rid of all the, like, truly ridiculous or offensive or whatever liquids that could come out of an alchemist jug. But the mayonnaise was the one thing. They were like, we got to retain one silly thing. And the mayonnaise is the thing that they retain.
And that turns into the rules debate, oddly enough. The one thing they get a little loose on that actually does turn, apparently, the long running rules debate is the one thing that you thought was just entertaining.
My group, my Sunday group, actually has an alchemist jug. Okay. And there's a lot of debate over who gets to have ownership of the jug. We've got one character who's a rogue assassin. And so, of course, he really wants to... producing poison because he wants to.
Okay, that's one of the. That's one of the substances.
One of the substances that can produce a small amount of poison.
Well, that's huge.
It sounds perfect for an assassin. We have another character who's a fighter and sort of role plays as this very ostentatious, lordly character. Always very impressed with his noble lineage.
Right.
And he wants it. He wants it just for so that he can have wine whenever he wants wine.
Okay, so that's something that doesn't have a huge amount of in-game effect. That's just
role-playing
flavor.
You're talking about a player who also is very proud of his Cape of Billowing, which, in case you don't know, Cape of Billowing is a magic item. It's a cape that the only ability it gives you is as a bonus action, you can cause it to billow majestically. Yeah.
What does that do?
Nothing.
That's actually in the book.
It's in the book, yeah.
Really? Is there a lot of stuff like that in 5th edition?
There's
like,
not, I wouldn't say a lot, but there's definitely some.
Really?
There's definitely some, yeah. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So far, he's won the argument. He's carrying around the jug so that he can have some wine whenever he wants.
Really?
You know, we have...
Wow.
As you know, magic item distribution can get pretty heated.
Yeah.
So we've actually shortcut that by having a go-to rule, which is we dice for it. So at the moment it becomes contentious at all, dice come out and we dice for it.
Okay, interesting.
And he won the roll.
Interesting. The first time, like, I hadn't seen that until we played in the Bill Webb game, actually, where that was just the way every single time, right? I think every single magic item that came up, just people rolled a number of dice according to their level, I think.
Mm.
Am I right? Maybe I'm thinking first edition Player's Handbook says that. And it was news to me of, like dice it out, because to me it seems like suboptimal team behavior, if I'm not crazy.
So William points out that mayonnaise was invented in the 16th century and is therefore anachronistic to include in D&D.
Nice point. Nice point.
So
major error.
Excellent.
See, this is why I normally don't run 5th edition.
So here's my question, then. What is the time period of Dungeons & Dragons? What year is it set in?
1300s. 1357.
That's very specific. You thought of this. Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is I think that's a choice. I think that's a choice that players can choose for themselves.
Yeah.
Look at a game like Lamentations of the Flame Princess, where it's far more Renaissance period, and I would say more likely that game is 1700s, maybe.
True.
Right? Do you have pirate ships? Do your pirate ships have cannons? That's also much more further in the future.
Right.
I think that's a thing the DM has to establish, and then you're going to have to make rulings. You know, I wrote a blog piece about tools,
right?
And I had a player challenge me with wanting to buy a drill, a hand drill, so that he could drill holes in doors and peek through them to see the monsters on the other side. And then I started thinking, well, when were drills invented?
Yep.
Modern drill bits didn't come until the 1800s.
Yep.
So, yes, there were drills during the Middle Ages, but they're really primitive compared to what we're used to.
Gotcha. And I've had to have the same discussion about, like, pulleys. I've had players wanted to use a pulley to pull something up. In the game, I made the wrong call. I said, no, pulleys aren't available. And the research later on was that, yes, they actually would be available. In fact, you can see them in medieval pictures of castle construction, of hauling up blocks of granite with a bunch of pulleys, actually.
I mean, so, you know, one might point out that in 1357, there was no tinning. No one had invented iron rations.
Except for the dwarves, exactly. That's what I'm saying. I agree. No humans have, but dwarves have special metallurgy technology.
That's a really interesting way of handling that kind of problem, right? Is to say that, well, maybe certain cultures that are pure fantasy could have invented some of these things.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And I think that's common also, like a lot of games say, you know, the only people that have cannons are dwarves, maybe. I think that's kind of a common.
Well, also, once you get into fantasy realms, you can start saying, like, okay, yes, well, my pirate ships don't have cannons, but they have wizards who cast fireball, right?
Correct. Exactly. So, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, so it's interesting that, like, a lot of people, you know, say that, you know, some people would argue nowadays that D&D doesn't actually have any particular real-world analog. But the original Little Brown Books actually do say, this is a medieval oriented setting, mm-hmm. and you should not expand to crazy other settings like the moon or science fiction until you have exhausted all of the possibilities in the medieval setting.
I feel like it's a taste choice, right? Like, I mean, look at Eberron, right?
Right,
like,
right.
And you get into a lot of more higher levels of technology.
You've got the lightning railroads, if you're not familiar with Eberron, stuff like. You've got the Warforged.
I totally think this is a choice that one can make. And I'm fine with anybody making any choice. Yeah. I think the most important thing is that the DM discuss that with their players, right? Set expectations so that a player knows, am I going to be able to buy tinned food? Am I going to be able to... get a hot air balloon, or is that something that doesn't exist in this
world? I mean, now, can you be completely comprehensive and encyclopedia with it up front? Probably not. I mean, we still get surprised. No, we still have to do research about whether a particular time period has certain technology or not.
Yeah, but you can set a baseline. You can say it's 1357 Europe, or, it's Renaissance period Italy, or,
Definitely. Definitely. I think I once challenged... I actually think I once, like, in an online forum, I politely asked Gygax, actually, of... the ship technology that you've got in original D&D, you have both, northern longship type ships, and you also have cogs and like naos and things like that. And those didn't exist at the same time. Are you comfortable with that? And he was comfortable with that. He was like, yeah, whatever. I didn't really pay attention to that so much.
I mean, I think you played pretty fast in those levels, right? Like, look at the whole oil problem, right? Is that kerosene, right?
And when was kerosene? Exactly, exactly. So, to bring it back to food a little bit, what do you... So, you know, we're talking rations, resources in the wilderness. What do your player characters... How do your player characters normally feed themselves in town, and how do you handle that? Like you just showed me a menu of specific things in the tavern. Do you, in your normal games, do you expect your characters to go to the tavern and price out what meal they're having?
No, generally not. Yeah. I feel like it probably depends on what the concept of the game is, right? In that game, it's getting together at a tavern, having a meal is all very much part of the plot of the game, right? So it's a feature of that particular game. I would say in a normal campaign, I usually abstract it a bit more. I might boil it down to just a daily cost of living.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So this many silver pieces per day is going to get you your room and board and, food for the day and et cetera.
Is that a choice that the players are making about, like, what level to... Like, I think I've seen some rules where the players are going to make a choice about, am I living a bare bones lifestyle or, like, a normal merchant lifestyle or, like, a high-class noble lifestyle with... maybe different advantages, disadvantages to those cost points?
It depends if the players want to dig into that or not, I think. Okay. Right? So some players, like, that's just tedious, and they just want to get back and go fight monsters in the dungeon, so we just flat fee, off you go.
Right.
You know, in other cases, it's more interesting, and I might even vary it based on location. How nice of a town are you in right now? Is this available?
Yeah.
Certainly, anytime my players start getting into that realm of, I want really nice food, I want really nice accommodations, I want really nice clothing, whatever, I say, well, then... You tell me how much you want to spend.
Okay.
Right? Because, the world's your oyster. If you've got money to burn, someone's going to sell you something to fit that budget. So
Now, interesting, see, in original, like 0th edition and 1st edition, that actually wasn't a choice. Is it's actually based on level, right? There's an upkeep cost that everybody's required to pay. You don't have a decision about it, and it just increases based on your level or experience. So the presumption... the core presumption in D&D is that, kind of like, Fafhrd, Grey Mouser, Elric type, I mean, they're inherently not terribly wise with their money and inherently free spending, and as they go higher up in level, they're actually just paying more and more money for presumably higher quality food, beverages, they're drinking a lot, buying, fancy wines and things like that. And so that's another thing sometimes surprises my players about, like, why are you charging us more and more and more money over time? And I'm like, you are not good with your money, and you are, but you are you're having to import better and better wines from further and further distant lands in order to satisfy your increasing hunger and thirst.
Honestly, this is where I get into more gamified systems where I want to do carousing, right? The players are, that is what carousing is, right? Carousing is having a good time, spending way too much money on food, on lodging, on entertainment, on whatever.
Right.
The whole point is, like, we just brought all this money back from the dungeon. Let's spend it and have a good time.
Yeah, the thing is, okay, so many, many people love the carousing rules, right? Everybody I play with usually loves carousing. Personally, I don't use them. The only problem that I have with it is that, you know, so obviously carousing rules, the main thing is you get extra experience and everybody's like really enthusiastic about it. But when I read the literature, like when Fafhrd and Grey Mouser go out and have an enormous party and lose a whole bunch of gems, they're not happy about it at the end. They're very sad about it. Mm. They lost all this stuff that they had previously. So for me, I kind of want some mechanic that makes you sad, very sad, instead of happy about losing all your money.
You know, I've heard from some other DMs who then use carousing as the sole means of gaining XP.
Understood.
That that XP is tied to gold pieces, and it's only gold pieces spent, not gold pieces earned.
Understood. It's a big reversal from standard D&D. Yep. It's a big reversal where the challenge is go in the dungeon and get out treasure. That's how you get experience. So to me, it seems like a big reversal.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I think ultimately what you're balancing here is much more of a game system than a setting element, which is the primary motivator generally for players is XP. What do you tie that to?
Sure.
By tying it to a certain activity, you are encouraging that activity to happen in your game.
Sure.
Right, so if it's killing monsters, then you're gonna have a bunch of murder hobos, and if it's if it's spending money, then you're gonna have a bunch of partiers.
But on the other hand, I find nowadays it seems like a lot of maybe younger people are actually really revolting against the idea of experience points. Like a lot of people.
Oh, now you have like stuff like fifth editions. Yeah. What do they call milestone based level?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I guess that's a whole different. That's a whole different episode of Wandering DMs, actually. But actually, I mean, I'm personally grappling with the fairly large number of people who say, obviously, I don't want to deal with experience points at all. Obviously, I'm using milestone leveling and just announcing levels when I feel like it.
I mean, I don't know. It does obviate a lot of fiddly questions one has to answer, right? There's a lot less of things you have to decide when you just say, everyone levels up when I say.
It's one of those things where, like, as DM, I don't trust myself a lot. I don't trust myself a lot. So having the objective points makes it concrete and objective in a way that I can't cheat it or make a bad decision that I'm going to regret later.
I mean, also, I would say it removes that element of a player motivator.
Right.
Since we just know you're going to level up whenever you feel like, what am I supposed to do? Right. What are my goals?
I agree. I agree. Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. So, I got a couple minutes more before the cookies are supposed to come out of the oven. I guess I'm going to just check them here. So sometimes people... Ooh, they look pretty good, actually. People... Let's go back where we were.
Yeah. Right. Sorry, I was going to show you that you can turn on the oven like that if you want to take it.
So sometimes people are in the wilderness and they've run out of food, and now they are going to have to sustain themselves on monsters.
Mm.
How much does a monster sustain your players in the wilderness?
Excellent question. I know. Depends on the monster, I suppose. What monsters are edible? What monsters are inedible? We had a game in our July live play game where you guys found a pot of cream of halfling soup.
Right. Well, that's clearly edible, right?
Delicious.
That's clearly edible. I mean, we didn't have it. That was the monsters.
Yeah, the ogres had it there. Right. And it wasn't clearly labeled, so...
Right. But the monsters know what they're cooking.
Yeah. Delicious halfling.
Great. That's a good question. I mean, a lot of stuff... I guess I've heard people being tricked with, like gelatinous cube gelatin. And I think, and actually there is a Gygax adventure where you can get served black pudding pie or something like that. Right?
Excellent.
There's a bowl of pudding on the table, but it's a black pudding.
Yep.
Which is one of the worst monsters ever. So not everything, but I tend to be. I think I'm giving every hit die is like, I don't know, three people days or something like that is what I'm doing these days.
I would usually assume most times when my players try to get any resource off of killing a monster, whether right. we're going to skin the tine right. or we're going to, you know, cook its meat or right. what have you. That, like, at most, it's something that's going to help you right then that day. There's nothing okay. that you're going to pack yeah. away.
Okay.
Right? Like, I don't know. I'm pretty harsh on that. Like, even like, right. like the, like, oh, I'm going to skin it. I'm going right. to, you know, skin this creature and take its hide. And right. like, well, are you going to, like, actually tan the hide? Or are you right. going to carry around a rotting skin for 3 weeks and forget that it's there? Right. And then try and pull it out in town and be like, look, right. I got this alligator hide. No, you don't. You have a rotten mess.
Agree. Yeah. So, and that makes a lot of sense, obviously. Again, without refrigeration or... you know, coolers or something like that. So I think for me, it's like you can kill the monster, you can eat it that day, and it's going to yeah. sustain you for like a week.
Yeah.
Is basically the idea, right?
Yeah. Wait, so you can eat it that day, and that's going to sustain you for a full week?
Yeah.
That's a big meal.
Oh, well, okay. Well, okay. Now we're debating. So what's your rule for starvation?
Oh, that's excellent. I actually don't have a standard one. I'd have to sit down and. I mean, it depends on what system I'm in, and right. et cetera, et cetera.
Let's say old school D&D. Let's say first edition D&D.
Yeah, I don't have one. You're forcing me to make one up on the spot.
Make one up. I've run out of food in the wilderness, great. And I'm days away great. From town.
So you can probably go 3 days with no effect. Then I would give you maybe another 3 or 4 days of penalties.
Okay.
And then I would start maybe taking hit points.
Okay. Okay, yeah. I think, I mean, I think that's similar to what I did in the past. I think I've simplified it so it's just 1d6 hit points per week.
There you go.
That's it.
Okay.
Right. So for me, it's like, did you lose hit points that week or not?
Right.
That's what I'm dealing with, and therefore that's right. So, it is, I think we're about 30 minutes that we've had the Wandering DM's white gold cookies in the oven. So I'm going to start pulling them out here and putting them on the cooling rack.
Can't wait.
See that?
Oh, very Three nice.
Cookies, pretty very good. Nice. You happy with that size there?
Yeah.
Great.
Can I eat them right now?
I think you probably want to cool them like just a minute, right? Am I crazy? You can try it. Tell me if it's too hot.
They're your cookies.
Well, it's your kitchen. The tray's hot.
Yeah, this is something my wife and I vastly disagree on. I like them piping hot out of the oven.
Really? Okay, well then go ahead.
If that's to cool.
Okay. Go ahead, tell me what you think. Some white chocolate.
That's a buy. I like the giblets. Very tasty.
Everybody likes giblets.
That's a nice cookie.
Awesome. That's excellent. So we should probably, I think that when this later on, we'll have the recipe for this in the in the notes.
The pan there on top of the
Sorry,
cookies.
Yeah, good point. It's just so incredibly hot.
Yeah, you're going to put the recipe right in the comments.
I'll put
the
recipe
video.
In excellent, the notes excellent. On the video, right, so people excellent. Can look that up.
Great. If anyone else has recipes that are specific to role-playing or use cases of food in their game, I would love to hear about it. I mean, I've only come up with those handful of Cthulhu games where I was able to use food as a prop.
Right.
I'm really curious if other folks have used food integrated into the game in some way.
I hadn't thought about that myself. That would be if you put a cheese plate in front of me, like in your Stilton game, I would not be able to avoid eating it myself. I would be immediately consuming that. So particularly as like a trick or a puzzle or something like that, that sounds like a really excellent choice.
It's fun. I mean, in that type of game too, usually the players are playing into, right? They're there for mm-hmm. to watch their characters make bad choices and befall terrible fates, mm-hmm. right? As that's my goal anyway in Cthulhu. So, you know, usually once that comes up and they go, great, I get cheese and does something terrible to my character. Even better, give me the cheese.
Nice. Yeah. I think this came out really well, actually. Yeah, I didn't know how it was going to work live. But actually, it did work well. I think that the large number of monsters that I had to destroy to get the ingredients was well worth this treasurable cookie at the end. Delicious.
Quite nice.
Awesome. All right. Is that anything else? Are we missing anything?
Any final thoughts on... food in role-playing games?
I like, you know, an old-school resource-based game, and I like it being gritty, and I like it being, you know, a bunch of things are being concrete that a player can sit down at the table and know what we're talking about, not even knowing any special D&D rules. So I actually do kind of like a game where you are talking about poles and swords and torches and food, And something that you can't immediately grip onto as being, you know, possibly threatening or something you really need. So I actually do still like having, you know, resource-based stuff around food in my game. And I think everybody can understand that.
It's funny, as you challenge me to come up with what are my rules for starving, the fact is, even though I agree with you and I like to have rules for deprivation and what happens when you don't have that stuff, I'd say that in pretty much every game I've ever run, my players are so worried about that not happening that it doesn't, right? That they are always prepared, or they are always getting out of there, or abandoning all of their plans to solve the food problem before it really becomes a problem.
Well, that's an interesting point. See, and like I say, with my current play group, it happened once.
Yep.
Right? It happened once that they got in trouble that the newer players weren't aware that might be an issue, and it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened after that. They've all been really, really, really careful to always buy those rations before they leave out. So it is interesting. It only happened really once, and then based on player initiative, they're always taking care of it. Yeah.
Excellent.
Cool. Yeah, so send us your recipes or send us your ideas for using food in games, and tell us if you want to see more cooking versions of Wandering DMs in the future here in Paul's Kitchen. Thank you for the apron cosplay from Isabella Garbani. We do appreciate it.
I would like to take a moment to highlight the work of a dear friend of ours who unfortunately recently passed away, BJ Johnson. We've played a lot of games with BJ. He's written a lot of his settings up, which can be found on DriveThruRPG under Big Fella Games. Mm-hmm. This is one of those. This is a Thousand Year Sandglass. It's an Arabian kind of setting, Arabian Nights kind of setting for Labyrinth Lord.
Yep.
That's generally, I think, Labyrinth Lord is what he wrote for. Brilliant artist, great game designer. We miss him incredibly. And so if you want to check out his work, you can find it on DriveThruRPG.
You should do that. It's really, it's a wonderful illustrator, wonderful artist, wonderful game designer. And Paul is correct, we all miss him very much. So you should check it out. You should check out what we have gotten to enjoy for many years at Big Fella Games on DriveThruRPG.
Yeah, presumably any further proceeds that come from that would go to his family or something.
I think, yes, exactly.
So,
right.
Yeah, please do check it out. Yeah, that's. I think that about wraps us up for today.
What can we look forward to next week, Paul?
Next week we'll be back to having special guests. Special guest Emma Lambert will be with us. She is the comms director for the show Web DMs, another excellent show of advice, DMing advice on the internet.
More than one.
And there's shocking. Right?
Really? Okay. All right. Well. Yeah. Okay.
So she'll be coming on to discuss with us how to make the most out of your convention.
Oh, I need that, actually.
Yeah.
I totally. That's actually something I don't do super well with, so I need that advice.
Yeah, so we'll be looking forward to speaking with Emma next week.
Great. Right. Is that how that works?
Yeah.
Great.
Yep.
Okay. right. Okay. So everybody, remember, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch under the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. So please look for us there.
Yes. And our show is also available in audio-only podcast format. You can find that at wanderingdms.com or any of the common podcast carriers such as Google Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify, etc. If you are listening to this show on one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate that. It helps us out a lot.
It does. And as always, thanks so much to the contributing patrons that we have that support and make the show better than it possibly would be without us. Without them. If you'd like to join them, please do look us up on patreon.com/wanderingdms. And we really do appreciate your support. As always, we are weekly at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Sundays. We'll be back next week with a new guest and for more thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.